Hi, everybody. This is Mark Ceffordini. Thank you for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Man, oh man, oh man. We've got some fun guests, some fun topics, and just a whole lot of F-U-N to put in your ears. That sounds terrible, but thank you for joining us once again. We are going to speak to a group of talented filmmakers who focus on shorts, and although they are shorts, they are tall in stature and wide in vision. So we go to hospitals, we deal with dinosaur blood, we go to farms, and we even have sleep studies. So let's go around the table, starting with, 10 o'clock. Margaret, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Margaret Miller, and I'm a writer, and I worked on Dress a Cow with Dawn, co-writing and general cow assisting activities. And I live in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, perfect.
And she's also prepping a new short film called Poof that we're shooting next month.
Yes, oh. I'm shooting a movie with Natalie, the brilliant Natalie, in about 1 month.
Wow. On screen, Natalie, behind the screen, on the script. God, you're everywhere. All right. Tiffany, let's go to you. How are you doing today?
Oh, great. Currently out with the film that we met over, Everybody Goes to the Hospital, at Kukulores. So pretty great. Excited. Yeah.
Miss Metzger, am I saying that right?
You are, yeah. Hey, everyone. So I am the producer of Dress a Cow, and I'm also producing Margaret's new short, Poof, and then I directed a short called Sleep Study.
Excellent. Dawn, how are you feeling today?
I feel great. I'm Dawn Luby. I am the co-writer and director of Dress a Cow with Margaret and Natalie. And yeah, excited to be here.
Well, happy to have you. And Senor Couch, Senor Sofa, Senor Scarf, you look great today. How's it going, Joe?
Oh, I'm doing great. My name is Joe Badon. I'm a writer-director. I did the short film, The Blood of the Dinosaurs. I've done a couple feature films. Right now, we just shot a mini-series that Blood of the Dinosaurs is a prologue to, called The Wheel of Heaven, and we're editing that right now. And there you go. Merry Christmas.
Excellent.
Joe and I are actually trying to do a project together. I feel like I have to interrupt you and say that because it's been all the excitement for me.
Yeah, we're working on, well, hopefully multiple projects, but we're doing some pitch decks together and very excited about that too.
Yeah.
Awesome. So you have the vision, you know what it's supposed to look like, and all you need is what? Fill in the blanks. How do you go from A to C? What's the B? Anybody?
Who are you asking?
Anybody, you know, I know it takes a whole lot. Like, it's the South Park thing. It's like the underpants gnomes. Step one, steal underpants. Step three, profit. Step two, and they all just go, I don't know. So maybe just around the room, what's the longest distance between two points? What's like the toughest thing to get moving in your process?
I think it's forcing yourself to create artificial deadlines that you have to stick to. Because I think it's really, really easy to work on something for years otherwise and never make it. Speaking as someone who's been writing a feature for like 4 years. But I think like with Dress a Cow, it was this idea I had. My directing partner, who I normally work with, was on maternity leave for 3 months. So I knew I had that amount of time to make something. And for me, the best way to do that is to email Natalie, and she's the most efficient person on the planet. And just tell her about it. And she's like, great, we're shooting, like we can do first week of August. I've contacted local crew in Cleveland. It's happening. Who do you want the DP? Da, da, da. And then I'm like, great. And then Margaret's like coming from Kentucky to help. So I think it's just literally setting a date, setting deadlines and sticking to them for me is the like hardest and most important part of making something.
Okay. Well, it's nice to have support, but Tiffany, what did you say?
Oh, I was going to say, I think for me, it's always convincing everyone that the craziest element is the most important thing. You know, once we're all in alignment, that is the thing, then we're good.
Okay.
So, you know, like, let's animate my mom's guts was really hard to convince people. And then once you find the right people, we're like, yeah, we're in. I want to animate your mom's guts. Then it was fine. But until then, totally no go for years.
Like, I gotta see this short. This sounds amazing.
It's real weird. Real weird.
It played in front of our feature Spoonful of Sugar at Fantastic Fest, and it was so fun to get to see it.
So cool.
Congrats. Yeah. Thanks. And Don, I feel like we met very briefly earlier in May. Because yes. I was like, wait, I've seen Dress a Cow and it's amazing.
Oh, thank you. It was so good. I know you look extremely familiar.
Yes. You know, like in passing.
Yes. Small world.
I think that for me, the hardest thing is probably, well, I've done everything micro budget so far, was probably all of, most of us have, maybe. And if not, then I'm jealous. But the biggest thing is, since you're not like paying most people, scheduling is a fucking nightmare. Fudging nightmare. I hate it. Like, having to make sure everybody, especially if you're doing like a big party scene, or if you have multiple key actors that are all supposed to be there that day, or lots of like kind of effects that all have to like go off together on the same night. I remember being like 2 o'clock in the morning with this fake head in the, you know, in very cold, damp weather. And like, we're about to like blow this head up. And my special effects guy, Charles, he's like, I hope this works. We only got one of them. And I was like, wait, we don't have a secondary like try. This is it. And it works, but you know, it's those sorts of things. But yeah, scheduling can be a nightmare. So yeah, that's my thorn in my side.
Okay. Well, do you ever find that when you're working on something, maybe the smaller it gets, the harder it is, because there's less things to like hide behind? You know, Natalie, you have 3 characters in your short. So is it like, hey, there's no, you know, secondary cast, there's no locations, there's no, you know, production value that we can lean on? It's really got to be honest. So and maybe the same thing, Tiffany, with animation. You know, it's like everyone's going to see the flaws or whatever you're worried about. Like, so how do you confidently move forward with that?
I mean, I think for Sleep Study, it was actually like in the writing process that all got worked out and kind of planned, because I wrote it specifically for my house, knowing that that was the easiest location that I could have, and kind of wrote it for these 2 actors, like knowing kind of like what their talents were, like kind of the vibe that I wanted from these characters. And so it actually made it kind of easy to have those limitations up front, like to know what the budget was. It was for Hulu's Bite Size Halloween. So like it was a set, you know, budget that was kind of greenlit and ready to go. And so it was like, okay, great. So I know what these limitations are. And that actually made it easy to be able to work within it, because then I knew what I was up against. And so, yeah, I wrote it for my own house. But then I think the crazy thing that I just decided to throw into the mix was that each scene would be a single take, because it, you know, part of the film is dealing with this blurred line between dream and reality. And so if you're just living in a single take, when strange things start happening, it makes it feel more real, because like you haven't cut to something. It's that it's just like you're living in the space with these people, and then something is there. And so when I pitched that to the DP, I think that was one of the hardest things, because it was like, okay, how are we going to do this one scene? You know, like one of the scenes happens upstairs, downstairs, there's stunts on either side, and do it all as a single take. And so it took a little bit of finagling for that. That was kind of the the mom guts version for me, Tiffany, of like, you know, like this is a thing that's like really important to me. That's going to be like hard and complicated, but because everything else was kind of tailored to what I knew the budget could handle, that was like the one extra thing that made it so that we could all kind of, you know, creatively problem solve that together.
Gotcha. Yeah. So Margaret, when you're working with Dawn and vice versa, what are the scariest things about problem solving? Is it, you know, the cows turn right when you need it? Are you hoping for any, you know, cinematic gold in one angle?
Well, I think the thing is, the interesting thing about Dress a Cow is it's about this competition where people dress up their cows in Canfield, Ohio. And we'd had no idea what the costumes were going to be. We didn't know if they were going to be good. We didn't know if they were, we had no idea when we kind of got there what our end point was going to be with any of it. I think it was a real fit thinking on your feet situation for 3 days, because I was like, a lot of my job was kind of to be like, I think we should probably talk to her more, because I don't know if we're going to go this way. I don't know. Like, so much Dawn dealt with in the editing process, or we dealt with it in the editing process. And so there was a moment, like, Dawn was always like, from the beginning, her whole thing was, I want these long, beautiful, slow-mo shots of cows getting pampered. Like, that was like her inspiration for the thing. And so it got to day three and we were like, we have to do slow-mo shots of the cows. So our DP, Jared, had actually worked with cows before. And I guess cows, they can see themselves in the camera. And so they often will pull away because they don't understand this thing. But we got a couple cows that just were hams, and they would follow the camera and they'd turn and they'd shake. So Dawn and I did a quick rush to a costume store that they had in Canfield, Ohio. And we had some boas and stuff. And we just made sure that we got all these really pretty shots of the cows. And then it was just, let's see what the contestants come up with the next day, which was a lot of stuff.
So good. So good.
Well, Joe, why don't we take a deep dive into your acid themed party? It's Mr. Rogers on, I don't know, Percocet, Vicodin, mescaline. It's the only way to fly, quote in The Matrix. So how do you do such a deep dive and commit to something? That, I mean, it's like, I think you're 17 minutes. Is that in your short? It is intense. So what was the genesis and the conviction?
I think at this point, like, the commitment is not to commit to anything at all, and to commit to that, where you're just like constantly changing. It's basically like, listen, it's what you do if you're a musician. And you're not a good musician, you put distortion on your guitar and it makes it sound like you're better than you are. And that's all I'm doing, is I'm like constantly trying to, in the editing room, like, if something's not working, then we're gonna fuck with it a lot and turn it into something absurdly stupid somehow. Like, there's a scene in Sister Tempest, my last feature film, that was, it was this scene that we didn't have a lot of time to shoot, and everything was one take, and it was all very, like, not the best lighting setups. And so it looked very amateur-esque. It was this running chase scene. It was supposed to be kind of like somewhat scary, but absurd at the same time, because it's a camera crew from another planet following this person around. But it just didn't feel, it felt stupid. So we just leaned into it, and we put a bunch of like Looney Tunes music in it. And we just put a bunch of like cartoon soundtrack things going on, like Foley sounds. And we just made it totally stupid. And we added like just public domain cartoons in there. And so it's just the idea of like covering up anything that I might've done wrong, you know, or just like covers up bad acting. It's great. It's just band-aids on things, you know, it's in having fun with it. So like what I try to do is what I call a cinematic mixtape. So like every scene should be like a different feel and a different genre, a different vibe and a different aspect ratio. And so we're just constantly like switching around and style hopping, essentially. It's just fun. It's more fun than just doing one or two tones for me. I have ADHD, obviously. That's it.
I remember there was a stand-up bit in Mike Birbiglia's, I think, second comedy routine, and he was talking about how he's like, you know, I don't think Yanni knows what his music sounds like. I think he's jazzing like, but it just comes out, wah, wah, wah,
wah, wah, wah, wah. Yeah, there you
go. Anyway, it just reminded me of, it's like.
That's it. Yes, exactly. I am the Yanni of indie cinema. That's me.
Right here. Layer it. Hey, Dawn, you know, what do you try to put into your, like, what's personal about your shooting style? You know, Christopher Nolan loved Batman, and even before he got the job to do The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, he put Batman wherever he could. What do you sly things in? What's a signature? What's a Easter egg for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think certainly the like inspiration for like each project is like rooted in something very real from some part of my background or life. With Jessica, for example, I spent a lot of time growing up on my parents' dairy farm and always did 4-H, and like county fairs were like a big thing. And I think it's like small communities and farm communities are like marginalized often, or like portrayed in a very specific way that's not very nuanced. And I was interested in like featuring that space, but also doing something like funny and light. I think so often doc shorts are incredibly serious, and I think there's a lot of really important, very serious doc shorts. I'm not saying they shouldn't exist. I think there really is a great need for them, especially now. But I think so often I sit through doc shorts blocks and I'm just like sobbing the whole time, like hoping for some kind of relief, that like a little bit of levity. So I thought it would, I guess, be fun with this to shoot it in the style of a very serious doc, but on a subject matter that is actually not that important. For this one specifically, kind of the part of me that inspired it was my background and my childhood. And yeah.
Also, I want to say that like Dawn doesn't usually go sentimental. Like her work is always very beautiful, but it's always dark humor. It's weird. Like it's, you know, it's a little left of center. And so for Dress a Cow, I think she did a very good job of like, it did turn out to be kind of a sweet sentimental story. And she didn't steer away from that because that's what we were presented with. It was just all these people that love their cows.
I didn't want it to be like a very earnest story and or have that ending, but there was no way around it. Like these people treat their cows like family members. Like one woman would late into the night every night, like go into the barn and lay with her cows and rub essential oils on them. Like, and so I'm like, well, I can't, like this love is real and I'm not going to make fun of it. I'm going to celebrate it. It was what it was. And I think with docs, you don't always get to fully decide the ending or the tone of it to some extent.
Well, when it comes to personal stories, Tiffany, I imagine it's probably tougher to get more personal than your story. Do you want to talk about the comfort and the strength to share that? You know, was there still any reservations that you held back from?
I did not have my mother's permission to tell her story before I started telling the story. So Everybody Goes to the Hospital is a story that my mom told me often while growing up at the kitchen table with her mother who lived next door, and my great-grandmother who lived next door. And they would sort of come over and recount and share in the telling of this story. So it's written and filmed as if told sort of with dolls, the way that they would tell the story. But I specifically wanted to tell it through my mom's perspective as a small child. And it always felt like it was a fairy tale or like a little golden book. And it was always sort of detached. So a lot of the ways that they would recount this, she had developed appendicitis in the early 60s. And they misread all of the signs because they'd all had the flu. And so they waited and waited to take her to the doctor. And so by the time they did, it had been a week, and the appendicitis had turned to gangrene of the intestines. So they had to remove all of her organs and wash them and then replace or put them back in her body. And the way that they would tell this, though, was as if it were totally normal. It happened, you know, it had this very strange otherworldly storybook tone. And, you know, a lot of people's grandmothers love to say really macabre, strange things. I don't know. My grandmother loved to point out everyone who had died down the street and how they died. And now, well, that's the butcher, and he got a blood disease and it killed his kidney and then he died. And you know, I didn't think that was weird at all until I went to college and then realized that a lot of people don't talk so casually about having all of their organs removed and then put back in their bodies. Like, this is actually a very unnatural, abnormal thing. And so then over the years, a lot of details would come up. Well, you know, your mom didn't think she could have children. So we didn't know that you could exist. So I was trying to capture this family spirit, but I had told my grandmother before she died that I wanted to tell these family stories. And I knew my mom didn't want me to tell any of these stories. And I was like, I need a little encouragement here. And she was just like, well, just, you know, be true, be honest, make it up if you have to. And so I took that as permission. And in the end, after it was done, I took it to my mom and had her watch it. And, you know, if you don't go to therapy, it's going to come out in art in your kids. So it's just a little PSA, like, go to therapy if you don't want a book written about you or a podcast or a film or whatever.
I can't wait to see what you and Joe do together. So this is a tremendous springboard into the future. Tiffany, and maybe the whole group in general, what is charming, although heartbreaking, about your mom's story is it's told from her as a young child. So what are your thoughts on like the unreliable narrator? Because I wasn't sure if it was going to go around, like, she's saying things she doesn't quite understand. And in Natalie's movie, Spoonful of Sugar, you have a young actor who's not quite told the whole story. So I guess, how do you work with a young voice actress, and, you know, how does maybe that play into the narrative?
Natalie, you have to start, because I feel like your actor not knowing is huge.
our feature Spoonful of Sugar that screened with Everyone Goes to the Hospital at Fantastic Fest, the lead actor is a young boy who was 9 at the time, and it's a horror film, and it's a very sexual film. There's like lots of erotic overtones and many different sex scenes with different people. And we obviously, like, he's 9 years old. So we were like, okay, cool. Like, we're going to let his parents lead the discussion with him of like what this movie is. And they, you know, kind of only gave him the, like, you know, bits of the scenes that he needed to know, and gave him some backstory so that he could understand like where his character was coming from, but didn't tell him everything, which I think is, you know, was the right thing to do, because there's a lot of brutal, brutal moments in the film. But I'm actually like really curious, like, when he gets old enough to watch, of like what his response will be after watching it and knowing, you know, all the things that happened behind, you know, when he wasn't on set. And he said at Fantastic Fest, he was like, yeah, well, I wasn't on set for the bad parts. So, which I thought was very, very cute.
That was really great. He was so good. And it was really shocking, I think, in the audience to be like, he doesn't know. He was so so good in the role that you're like, you have no idea how this reads. It was lovely. The child in our film, Everybody Goes to the Hospital, she is a 5 year, or she was 5 years old at the time, and her father was a poet and spoke. Her mom speaks to her in Polish, her father speaks to her in Spanish, and so she is this trilingual 5 year old who has a really wonderful vocabulary, and they play all of these word games. So we had wanted to make it really fun for her. So, you know, she requested to be paid with professional bongos as a non-actor. And so we may have made that happen. And I tried to actually cast this with an adult. The goal was to have an adult doing all the voices. And then it wasn't fitting. It felt really, I don't know, just awkward. And so we kept trying to figure out, like, how are we going to do this? And a friend who's in development at Disney was like, it's got to be a child. You need to try to do a child. And so I was getting really nervous about the whole process. And then I remembered, actually, my friend Van sent this poem that his daughter had recorded for him. I was like, wait a minute. And I threw the poem up against the footage. Actually, my partner, who's also the composer, threw it up against the footage, and we just hit play, and it fit perfectly. And we're like, wait a minute, we have to do this with Lucia. This is the right voice. This is the right child. And yeah, I think it works really well.
Her voice is perfect. It's so great.
That's the best part about post-production, is like finding those like little gems while you're throwing music in there and narrations in there and all that kind of shit, or just rearranging scenes. And then you're like, oh, well, that's perfect. I love those moments.
Well, Joe, you have a young actress in your short and a baby. So what's that casting process
like? No, that was not a real baby. So that was just a...
I'm so glad to hear that.
We did not eat the child. But yeah, that the purity, the young girl, that's Stella Creel. She has been in everything I've done except for the new miniseries that we just shot. But yeah, she was like, she went to my church, and I was friends with her mom, and we were casting for God Inside My Ear, my first feature film. And she was just like so dang cute and perfect. And she was like, hit all of her notes and, you know, knew all her lines. She was like so professional. You know, I was like, this, she's great. So yeah, she's been in all my stuff, and she's just got a charm to her, and a good professional attitude and a cool mom. So yeah, of course I'm going to keep casting her.
So here we are in November. I'm sure that each of you running the festival circuit, you're probably worn out, gas tanks get a little empty. Who has maybe a crazy story from, you know, a far-flung place in Seaches or Sydney or Sacramento, like someplace, like who has just like, what's something you can't shake after going through festival circuit?
I feel like the festival experiences have all been so wonderful that like I don't know if there's anything like crazy that happened necessarily, but
well, this was your first year back too, right, Natalie? Like for a lot of the festivals that you usually go to, wasn't this the first year that a lot of
we had two features at Tribeca last year, and had a film at South By. So I guess it's, yeah, it's definitely been, I guess, in terms of the pandemic, seeing the festivals come back, it does feel like this year is the first year that it's like fully back in person, in the theater, not outdoor pods, and like the events are back, you know, filmmakers are, you know, shoulder to shoulder inside a room, like talking and sharing stories. And so that's been like really, lovely is having those experiences again, because we were without them for so long. But yeah, for us, it's been a little bit crazy because I think we have three features and two shorts doing festivals right now. So it's a little bit of like, okay, where are we going next, and what's playing there and what's playing somewhere else? And so, but it's, you know, it's like really fun to have them all kind of hitting at the same time too.
Well, we were both at, Natalie and I went to, and Dawn went to South by Southwest this year, and Natalie and her partner in Vanishing Angle, Matt, like they were, you know, it was my first time at, I think, like my third time at any film festival ever. And like, oh, we have this meeting, and then we're doing this meeting, and then we have this panel. And I was like, are you going to see any movies? And she's like, oh, no, you don't see the movies. Like there's just so many meetings, you know, because, well, and she's got her hat and her hands in a lot of pies, finger in a lot of pies. Is that it?
A judge's ruling.
Is the hardest part, is going to these festivals and there's so many cool movies that I want to see, and I end up having like interviews that I'm doing, or I'm going to a panel or something like that. Dang it, that movie, yeah. I really wanted to see it. Now I gotta wait till it comes out on video. It sucks.
Because it's technically work, right? I mean, everything you're doing is promotions and publicity and stuff. So you're on the clock. I mean, this is my side gig. I work for an architecture firm. So it's like, if you ever tell somebody, hey, I'm going to Tahoe or I'm going to Fort Lauderdale, it's like, hey, enjoy having your toes in the water, Mark. You go, nope, never even left the hotel. So yeah. Like, it just is what it is. But how do you feel, Tiffany?
Oh, this is my first time taking something that I wrote and directed out on the festival circuit. And so, you know, it's also my first animation project. And as a non-animator dabbling in the animation space, that's also, it just felt really exposing on a lot of levels, but it was really exciting to do that. And I felt like it's been rather magical to take something that probably one of the first stories that I wrote, and I've had so many people either try to make it or tell me that's not something, it's not producible, it's too dark, it's too weird. I even finished the film and was asking for advice from a festival director who was like, this isn't gonna do very well. So it was really helpful when it actually started doing well. She's like, this is gonna leave people feeling bad. And are you sure? It's kind of lying to them about what it is. As a stop motion, people think it'll be cute and nice and fun and uplifting, and it's not. I'm like, oh, okay. But it was nice to make the thing that I wanted to make in a way that it is not how it would be made if we hadn't done it this way. So and it was only possible because of the pandemic. I'd been actually working for some strange architects and VFX artists and Disney Imagineers. And so a lot of the fabrication knowledge that came and then influenced the making of the film came from being in this funny half entertainment, half film finance, half, you know, it's like just a bizarre little think tank. And would not have been able to pull it off if I didn't know how to work with designers in a very particular way and then actually execute. So it was just this like amazing experience to go into the festival circuit. And the first festival we went to, Phil Tippett was there, and he gave us an award, and it changed everything for the project.
That's just right.
Like, here you go. And I was like, wait, but this is the first, like, this is too much, but thank you. Like, here we go. So I don't know. It's like, it seems unrepeatable. So.
Okay. Well, great. No, I think that's fantastic. I think but the follow-up to that is like, when sometimes when a director works for a studio gets the cut that they want to distribute. And, you know, like I was having a conversation today, Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven has a fantastic director's cut. The cinematic one, you know, lost a lot of fans along the way. But as shorts directors, do you get, like, who tells you or tries to control? Is there a limiting factor, or do you get final cut?
I get final cut. I mean, but it's all micro budget stuff. So yeah. It's like answering to your friends, really. I mean, it's like I have a production company, but we're all like friends. And so it's all, you know, it's all business. But, you know, when it usually, I would think most good teams are going to let the director have final say most of the time, unless it's totally just not, you know, just out of the blue crazy. But
I think it just depends on like where the financing is coming from. So like, you know, a lot of short films are crowdfunded or self-financed in some way. And so obviously with those, the director's going to have final cut. And then, you know, other times it's like part of a lab or something like that, where it's like assumed that the director will have like a lot of power. But I think if wanted, like, you know, the studio could step in. Like for Sleep Study, you know, technically it was 20th Digital and Hulu who owned the short, who financed the short. And so they could have come in and like kind of, you know, done whatever they wanted with it. And like, you know, we went back and forth on a few things, particularly the ending, where I had an ending that I like, you know, had kind of written it for, and they weren't sure about going that far with it. And but they were really wonderful, honestly, and like always listened, you know, whenever they had notes, some of which were like really, really wonderful and useful. But they would always like listen to like to my perspective and like, you know, oh, well, I did that for this, but like actually maybe we can solve that through this other thing. And at the end of the day, they let me keep the ending that I was really pushing for, which like I'm so appreciative of. And I give them a lot of credit for like letting me kind of take the risk. And I think that's been like the thing that has been like the most talked about with like the different press interviews and stuff is the ending. And so I really, you know, appreciate how open they were to collaborating.
No, that's great. Cause I think this is my note after watching the short, and all it said was, wow. I mean, I laughed at the Dad Hood for Dudes book, but when you got to the end, I thought, well, I'm not sure I would ever want to peek inside Natalie's mind, because if that's what she feels comfortable sharing, I'm not sure what she would try to hide from the world. But you have to be truthful in these endeavors. So, I mean, congratulations to all of you. I love the honesty and it may sound like we're wrapping up, but really not. I just wanted to give you guys a virtual round of applause. So I've been enjoying this as well as your productivity. So thank you.
Well, thanks for watching all of our films.
So, you know, when they say, to quote Mitch Hedberg, as a comedian, you got to start the show strong and end the show strong. You can't be like pancakes, all exciting at first, but by the end, you're fucking sick of them. So do you try to like find a mellow groove throughout the short, or do you just try to like middle, and then pow, something at the end? Like, how do you first approach your process?
I think when I'm primarily a writer, I'm going to be a director next month, but I've never done it before. I love a twist ending, and I often struggle because my background is in playwriting. So I like to know the end before I start the beginning. And when I did my MFA in Dublin, and my roommate was the opposite. And she was just like, she'd sit at her desk and just go. And I would have like note cards of like the architecture of the whole piece before I could just kind of start writing the dialogue. And what that did, that's not bad, but what it did was I don't think that way really serves exploration or just kind of a stream of consciousness of like what you can come up with. So my roommate's plays were always much better than mine, even though mine were like kind of like attempting something a little bit more sophisticated. But I think that's like, since I started writing, that's always been a thing. Like, how much do you just kind of sit at your desk and go? And I think most writers deal with anxiety, and sitting at the desk can be a tricky one anyway. And so knowing where you're going is always really helpful. It, you know, it calms you down a little bit, but it can become stale pretty fast, and it can feel forced. So I don't know as far as filmmaking, but as far as writing, I'm trying more to just kind of go with it and see what happens, and not be so clean because I used to think clean writing was really good writing when it was circular, when it came back to itself. And so to kind of let yourself be more experimental, that's what I'm trying to do more now as an artist.
Oh yes. I love that. That's something I've been trying to do as much as possible as well. One thing it's funny, like, because we all obviously all have our ways that we create, you know, but storytelling is fascinating to me because I'm trying to do the opposite as much as possible and see if it works. I'm trying to go against, like, every rule as possible, but I still always need a beginning and an end. Like, I always need a fucking end. For me, it's like, I cannot even do it. Like, I need, like, to know that that's going to be a cool ending that eventually I'll get to. I don't know how I'll get to it, but I'm going to, like, steer the car blind until I run into it. And so that's what I try to do. So it's a similar vibe I try to go for, but I wait until I have a good ending before I start, like, writing. And I give myself little, like, pit stops that I kind of... So I give myself like 3 or 4 pit stops along the way from the beginning to the end. And then I try to write as, like, turn my brain off and just write as much as possible. Cause there's so much, like, discovery that happens that you just never would get there before, you know, just like that instinctive, intuitive creating. I am fascinated with that lately. So I'm right there with you. I just want to throw that out there.
I'm obsessed with Murakami's memoir that's called What I Talk About When I Talk About Running. And I had read that probably 2018, 2019, right as my grandmother was dying. And I knew that I wanted to make this short, and I knew that I wanted to do larger projects with my writing. And I found it so satisfying to read about a novelist who publishes every other year and then has this intense gap year of translating his own work from Japanese into English. And then he's always at the same time doing that lecturing as well as plotting the next thing. And so he's constantly training for a marathon and all these physical contests year round, while writing, while translating, and while teaching. And I was like, I'm not trying hard enough. I can do more. I know that there is no reason why I shouldn't take his advice and just focus. It doesn't matter where I begin or where I'm ending. I will be at this point. And just putting those things just into the calendar, like seasons. Here we go. We're just going to keep going. And you can do so much more than you think you can. I think as writers, we tend to get really excited about an idea and then obsess over it. But you have to kind of have multiple ideas going as a director and as a producer, because it's not just one thing. And I started to recognize, like, I am a writer, I'm a director. And in moving stories ahead, sometimes you move this story ahead a little bit faster because everything's coming together, and then you have an insight into something else. And so I think that was something that I really found helpful when trying to take on something that seemed really insurmountable. Like, oh, we're going to fabricate all of these puppets and sets, and we have 3 months to do it, and we only have this much money. And then we need to somehow convince someone to have multiple stages running at the same time. But it's a pandemic, so, you know, you have to, like, keep it small, contained, but still.
I have so much jealousy for writers that know the ending ahead of time. I, like, have never been able to do that. And I think that's like the most useful and necessary with a feature script, because I think, you know, the kind of starting at the beginning and just kind of seeing where it goes can be fun. And especially for like a short, you know, you can kind of like lead yourself into a twist that you didn't see coming and then like, oh, cool, great. But for a feature where there just naturally needs to be a little bit more structure, I think that's like, you know, harder. But I have so much jealousy for people that know the ending ahead of time, because I definitely don't. And I'm one of those people that just like sits down and starts writing. But like what I try to do is I try to, especially with like sleep study, just like do a lot of research ahead of time. So I was just reading a lot of books about sleep disorders and neuroscience and the brain and just the weird shit that our brain does. And so that was kind of all in my head. So as I started writing, you know, my brain was just naturally pulling from these like weird things that I had just, you know, learned about. And so I think that's kind of what allowed it to lead to where it did. But I definitely didn't know where it was going to go when I sat down.
I love projects that involve research at the beginning because it's easier. It's just an easier door to walk through is reading. Like it's taking notes than sitting down at a desk and coming. So I love when it's like you, and then, you know, then the wheels start turning.
I love to do those kind of character breakdowns with the research so that you can feel like you're sort of, how would they respond to this research? So I like to do this sort of like co-development where you're inputting and then slowly you're like, oh, actually Joe would do, and then fill in the blank.
I have like never done like Bibles ahead of time. I've never done research ever. I literally like just, I try to think of what in my world, in my brain, would this character be like constantly, or like, what would, like, I don't do research on like, what would a, you know, it's so stupid. I need to, but I always am like, I'm trying to think completely on the fly, like so much so that the research will bog me down. And then I never get started on the project. So it's just like, you know what? I have an idea and I'm going for it. And then after the rough draft, and after I send it off to like five or six other writer friends or more sometimes, just depending on how excited I am about it. And then they give me a bunch of notes, and then I'll do a little bit of research after that, especially I have one writing partner that kind of comes in and tells me if I'm being completely stupid or absurd too much in different ways. But so like that first and second draft is where research comes in and rewrites come in after that. My rough drafts, there was something that George Lucas said, he's not a good example of like fine writing really, but he said like an advice that was given to him from Francis Ford Coppola. So this is like advice upon advice. But there was this thing that Francis Ford Coppola said to him, said, just start writing. And like, just don't think. Just write. And then afterwards, you know, go back and fix things. So I just don't think at all. And research just scares the shit out of me, at least at first. You know, so there you go.
Yeah, it's that old adage, which I don't recommend, or as you get older, I recommend it maybe up until 25, and then, which is write drunk, edit sober.
Yes. Well, it's the idea that the kings of old would like do that thing where they get really drunk and then they would look at all like the laws and all the things, the decisions for the kingdom. And then the next morning, sober, they would look at all their crazy writings and see if any of that made sense.
Yeah.
It's the same idea. Yes.
I heard that's how Hammurabi's code came to be. The original draft was both eyes, but now it's like, anyway, well, let's talk last thing. So the fact that you guys put so much of your time and energy into this, you know, Natalie has a poster of Werewolves Within behind her. So like, You know, a musician has vinyl. An artist has a sculpture or whatever it is like that. So, you know, what is the proudest thing that you can tote around to say, this is what I did, it's here, and like, what gives you the most satisfaction in your job?
Well, if I were at home, I would make you look at the house that is a 3.5 foot foam sculpture that lives above all of the very, very large puppets. Usually stop motion puppets are about 10 inches or less. Ours are a classic Barbie 1962 model. And so they're slightly bigger than they should be, which has its own unique set of problems. But you know what? When you just dive into animation, you're like, well, we're going to do it accurately. Maybe that's not the best method, you know, but it worked out. So I have all of the dolls and they terrify people and I love it because I was the kid who had like 50 porcelain dolls that would be aimed at the door. Homeschool, you know, it's all explained right there. But yeah.
I guess for me, it's that moment when I watch that at least a decent first cut. Like just on my laptop, just by myself, that's the best experience. That's what it's all like there for, is to watch a decent working cut, all cut together with, you know, it feels good. You're not like bothered by the sound too much or anything. You're able to enjoy what you've done. That's it right there. That's what I'm doing it for.
What about you, Natalie?
Yeah, I mean, like in terms of physical things, like I guess the only things would be like, you know, the posters and the like festival awards. But like to me, it's much more satisfying when I see the stuff I've worked on like pop up in like random cultural things, you know, like someone making a fan art, you know, like character or figurine of like the main character, or someone dressing up as one of the characters from one of our films as like for Halloween, or like things like that, where it's like, oh, this is having an impact beyond just, you know, the amazing thing that, you know, like I feel like I work towards, which is sitting in the audience for the first time and actually experiencing it in the theater and like hearing everyone's responses. Like that's always to me the magical moment that I like work towards, but seeing it have like a lasting life beyond that is something that's like really special and cool to see.
Excellent. And Margaret, looked like you were going to reach for something.
I did. Well, so I did a play earlier this year on my husband and I. It was my first autobiographical kind of play. Like it was a two-woman show in here in Kentucky. And it was called Infertility, and it was on our fertility struggles and our pregnancy loss and things that we've gone through. And so I was doing it, and it was this element of like, I didn't, even though I know playwriting, I'd never produced a play before. I didn't know what to do. And my husband was like, I'll do the poster for you. Like I'll do a poster. And he has kind of a little bit of a graphic design. So I walked in one day and he had like made this little poster for me. And I saw it and I started crying because it made me feel legitimate in this way. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come from external things. It just came from him. And so I think like, it's interesting where you cross the line of like, oh, I'm a professional. Like this is my job, or this is my thing that I do even. And I feel like that was a moment where I was like, oh, okay. Like that, like I was really actually making something. And it was like kind of putting, it was, if you build it, they will come kind of thing. Like he was like, this is a play. And then I was like, okay, I can do it. And it went well.
That's awesome. Yeah. I think all of you, Dawn included, can confidently walk across any football field and pull a Judd Nelson, just like throw your hand in the air, like, yeah, we did it. So very, very, very happy for each of you. Very competent, very very quality material, and the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. So it's been a joy chatting with you about the process and what you're able to put in front of people. So last question, you know, when you're an artist or when you're trying things out, you know, your parents usually try to be your biggest advocate, like, those jokes are great, Mark. So who's your biggest advocate and who's the toughest to please in your lives?
My biggest advocate is my husband, but he was just for the first many years that we were working together, just my work colleague, but he's always the one that, you know, if I'm like questioning whether I should do something, or if I'm like, oh, well, I'm like producing all these things, so the stuff that I'm writing or directing can wait. And he's like, no, let's prioritize those things. Let's like put those in the mix. He's always the one that's very supportive in reminding me about the things that I'm capable of. And I think the hardest to please, I think like some family members just like still kind of like will watch the films that I work on and just like, what is this? So I think it just depends on the film and like the genre of it, you know, with different people responding in different ways, but there's still always a question. I think when my mom watched Sleep Study, she said, I can't believe that came out of my daughter's brain. And she was she was very concerned for me, so but she's also very, very supportive.
Yeah, I think Tanya, my wife, is like, she's the one that I kind of write all the stories for, really, you know. And so like, it's like, if she doesn't like it, then I'd like change it, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of, it's kind of the muse sort of situation. So yeah, she's like the big inspiration for me. If things aren't going well, then I'm not very creative, and if we're doing great, then I like just create all the time. It's a symbiotic relationship. But and then as far as I'm, so for me creatively, I'm doing things that are fairly abstract, fairly Dada-esque and weird and surreal, and you know, you deal with a crew and cinematographers and editors and, you know, sound design and all the crew members that have all their different ideas. So if I know that if I can get like my little group of like crew members and producers that I really creatively collaborate with, if they all like the idea, then I'm like, hell yeah, I did something right. So they're creative little hive brain, because they're all coming from different walks of filmmaking. If I can get them all to agree with me, then you know, that's the hardest ones to make happy. If I can make them happy, then that's great, then we're doing something right. So
I definitely feel like my partner Mackenzie is my biggest supporter and has always like helped me find my voice. And just from the beginning, I didn't know that I wanted to be a filmmaker. I thought I was religiously homeschooled and had a very like Supreme Court path dream of becoming a lawyer and like doing all these very specific things. So when I got out of that world, it was really hard to figure out how to access an individual voice. And so I would say that he's been there with me through that journey. my mother is always very, very upset about everything that my creative life. She was like, you know, it'd be nice if you told a happy story, a good story, you know, like why can't you just make something nice and light? And I was like, well, that's just a little column A, column B, where we are each other's like, we created each other. So some of this is because of you, some of this is because of me, but you know, we're gonna be on this journey together. And so, you know, sometimes I've made things that I thought she would hate and we would have this permanent enmity, Like I wrote a short story. First thing I ever wrote and performed was about how my parents pulled my baby teeth out with pliers and they thought this was a wonderful story. They came. I got so nervous about telling the story. I was like, it felt like I was about to traumatize the whole audience. And I got so nervous that I threw up and I came out and I read it. The only people in the audience who laughed were my parents. They laughed hysterically the whole time. They were like, wow, you are such a writer. We see it. We love you. This is amazing. And I was like, wow, I really thought that one, I'd be disowned. And like, apparently you can tell the truth, even to people who are a little like, don't say it like that. You can actually tell your side and it will take you in surprising and unexpected places. So like, it's like a positive negative in so many ways. So.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Margaret, bring us home.
I would probably say my husband, of course, and then Dawn's husband is actually a writing partner of mine on a couple projects. And I knew Dawn, in the director of Dress Account, in college. We went to college together. And then she married this guy, Jeff, who our little group became friends with. And I would tell these, and my life was going kind of a certain way. Like I got my MFA and then, you know, what do you do with an MFA? And, you know, I was working in a beer shop and I was fixing up my grandmother's house. But I would text Jeff these long texts, like these stories, like just like ridiculous, just to make him laugh. And then I think he said to me, he was like, I think we should get you writing again. And then, he was like, what if we work together? And then those deadlines that Dawn was talking about kind of came into play, where every Friday we would meet. And he's just always really championed my writing. Like he's the one that's like, nope, this is, you need someone, any one person that's like, nope, you gotta go. And Jeff was definitely that for me. And he's that for a lot of people too. And then my mom, you know, she just says I love her very much, but she's just always very confused. And she says, I don't get it. She loves me, but she's just very like, she's like, oh, that's so cool. I don't get it, but it's great that you're doing something. So yeah, that's it.
Well,
we love our moms, but they're...
Say what?
We love our moms, but yeah. They're just...
Now you kind of understand why Eddie Murphy in Nutty Professor, Hercules, Hercules, Hercules. Yeah. So proud of the offspring. So, and everybody should be proud of you. Did we just become fest friends? I think we did. I would love to get this group back together sooner or later, before Christmas, whatever you celebrate. But absolutely, 100% thank you to each and every one of you. Give best wishes to Dawn, Margaret, Tiffany, Natalie, Joe. You guys are amazing. To really cut out, tell us where our viewers can expect to see you and what you got next on the books, if you're allowed to disclose.
I think, Natalie, isn't Dress a Cow going on to Vimeo next month?
Yes, it will be finally online for people to view in December, mid-December. Mm-hmm. And we have a couple films that I produced that will be releasing in March. Our feature, It Ain't Over, about Yogi Berra, will be releasing in March in theaters with Sony Pictures Classics. And then our feature, it's a sci-fi film called The Park, which will also be releasing by XYZ in March. And then we have a couple shorts that will be doing the festival circuit next year that we're in the middle of finishing and about to shoot Margaret's. And I have also a feature sci-fi script that working on getting off the ground and hopefully shooting in a year or two.
I am basically finishing up with Hospital. We're about to hit our calendar year and talking to a few people about where to put it online. And at the same time, in the process of finishing a feature doc that I've worked on for the last 10 years, And so in that lovely edit, final edit stage with that, and doing a lot of puppet development that is, so I have a quarterly variety show at the Bob Baker Marionette Theater in Highland Park, Los Angeles. And there's been a lot of strange puppet collaboration because apparently once you make a puppet movie, you make lots of puppet things. And it's been a wonderful glittery rabbit hole, and there will be more.
So I have two feature films online. If you look me up, God Inside My Ear and Sister Tempest. And those are available already online. Got, the short film, Blood of the Dinosaurs, we're looking for, you know, some sort of distribution possible. You know, shorts are weird like that. But it will be available online probably in the next like 6 months. We're still like hitting some festivals with that. I'm just wrapping up a mini series that I shot called The Wheel of Heaven. We are finishing editing that, and that's about to go through the film festival circuit. That's like a surrealist mini series about a woman who is reading like a choose your own adventure type of novel. And it's kind of like her choices is showing how it changes her life basically through the choices she makes through the book. And then I have like four feature films. Basically, we have a production company called Cosmic Family Films. You can look that up, cosmicfamilyfilms.com. And we are now just creating pitches and writing scripts. So we have about four feature films that we're developing and about six TV series, including one or two that we're working on with Tiffany, which will be exciting. But it's all very surrealist, Adult Swim kind of absurd level shit. So if you like that kind of stuff, that's what we're doing. So
Too Many Cooks and Danger 5. I love it.
Yes.
All day long.
Hell yes.
Well, great. Sounds like, you know, take that, Netflix. Look at all this content coming your way. So guys, it's been a pleasure. We will catch you next time.